Brand new episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show coming up next. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We're 1 week into the NBA season, and today we're talking about Monday night's games with my good friend Dumin Rangula. He's a big Lakers fan, one of the smartest people I know. Great discussion with him talking about Lakers and Suns, Nuggets getting their first win, the Bucks, whether it's time to press the panic switch, and a bunch else. And then I brought on Dane Moore, excellent podcaster covering the Minnesota Timberwolves. And then we open up the mailbag answering some of your questions. Send them over for next week to KOC Show at yahoosports.com. Let's get to it. All right, Dumin, your Lakers lost tonight 109 to 105 in Phoenix to the Suns. A game between two legends, Kevin Durant versus LeBron James. One of them, LeBron, looked very old. Only had 11 points. Kevin Durant, on the other hand, dropped 30 points, hit clutch buckets down the stretch. He had 10 points in the final 4 minutes and change. He had a big block on Rui Hachimura with about 3 minutes to go. Big disparity between the two old heads in tonight's game. What are your thoughts coming out of this?
Yeah, it was a little jarring. Like, there's the angle of looking at, kind of zooming out on the Lakers season, very happy about where we are, very happy about the start. A loss like tonight, you know, they just played the Suns a couple of games ago. In this circumstance, on the road, you would expect that loss. But it was jarring watching LeBron. I know, like, people will tell you who followed LeBron, like, there is a ramp-up process that he goes through to start seasons. But today was pretty jarring to watch. And it was not only physically, there were some mental decisions he made, probably because he physically wasn't able to do what he probably thinks he should be able to do. And he was just struggling in ways that is hard to see. And obviously, Kevin Durant, I mean, there's not enough superlatives to talk about the way he still goes at it night after night at this age after all his injuries and all that. So, I mean, I always look forward to these matchups between them. And we can get into the team stuff later. But just stepping back, it's like, how many more of these LeBron Kevin Durant matchups are we going to have? I love every single one of them.
I mean, hopefully we get at least what Shams has had, two more years at least of LeBron James. We'll see. I think you mentioned those, you know, ramp up starts for LeBron James. Obviously he had one unbelievable performance this year, but other than that, it all has felt like a ramp up for him. And yet in the context of the Lakers, after every game, including even this one, they lose to the Suns. And yet I'm like, oh my God, JJ Redick, the ATO he drew up for Austin Reeves, that he missed the three at the end of the game. It just feels like this team continues to play with movement and motion and shooting. There's a purpose to what the Lakers are doing. So even though LeBron looks older, 80s been unleashed. Austin Reeves and Rui look better, and the team complexion, everything just looks so much more crisp with JJ Redick rather than Darvin Ham. What are the differences that you've perceived with this year's Lakers team compared to last year under Darvin Ham?
I love that you focused on specifically that they're playing with a purpose. And this goes back to when JJ Redick was introduced as coach, and he was talking about his training camps and his practices. And he's been very clear since he got hired, and, you know, we'll see how it pans out for the full season. But he talked about, hey, we're not going to waste time. When we're at practice, we're at practice. We're going to have short, good practices. We're not going to waste time. We're not going to waste anything. And that has translated early to the season. I want to highlight one specific moment in today's game that would have never happened. And I don't want to dump on, you know, just Darvin Ham. Obviously, he's the coach that he replaced.
You can dump on him. You can dump.
I'm just going to say this would not have happened last year. But in the third quarter, at the end, shot clock's coming down. There's about 10 seconds left in the game. And the Lakers are not getting any good shots. And there's no movement. Like, there's nothing happening. He calls a timeout with 10 seconds left. Not much time left on the shot clock. The Lakers are up. It's almost like a meaningless possession in the sense of, okay, whatever, you know, you go into the quarter and you can make your adjustments. He called timeout, called a great ATO for Gabe Vincent, who was struggling that game. The corner three.
Yeah.
And it's like there's such a professionalism on every possession in every shift. Now, every matchup is not going to work out perfectly. Every game is not going to work out perfectly. Every shot is not going to go in. But the purpose of even that single possession is something that I will say, like, I was one of the people who, while I thought it was time to move on from Darvin Ham, I thought he was getting too much blame. It turns out, like, there's a lot to coaching day to day. There's an accumulated effect. And the professionalism that he's brought culturally to this team, JJ Redick, has far exceeded my expectations, especially for a first-time coach who hasn't even been an assistant at the NBA level. And so I'm glad you circled on the purpose point, because, look, the movement you're talking about is great. But first and foremost, we don't know what this team's going to look like after the trade deadline. We don't know what this team's going to look like next year or whatever. But what he's shown so far is, and look, there's players like Jared Vanderbilt who are going to come back. Christian Wood's going to come back. We don't know what those rotations are going to look like. But what I do have confidence in is that they will play with a purpose every single night. They will fight every single night. Just this season, they've fallen behind. Like in that Sacramento game you were referencing where LeBron James went off, they were down big and they just clawed back. Same against Phoenix. They were down big at home. And I was actually at that game. And I just never felt like they were out of it. And just like tonight. Tonight's a game where you could have written them off and saying, okay, they're 3-0. They're on the road. They just played Phoenix. Phoenix is very motivated. It's like a loss on paper. But they still fought right down to the end. And I do think that so far has been, obviously the way they're running the offense is much better. Their defensive schemes are much better. But first and foremost, I think him getting the culture and buy-in to that level to start with is the biggest difference between last year and this year.
It feels like for the Lakers, a foundation is being laid that's going to last post-LeBron. If LeBron only lasts 2 more years or 3 more years or even just 1 more year, JJ is looking so far, again, just four games in. But I think when you assess JJ personality-wise with what we know of him, with his meticulous personality, how obsessive he is, how smart and intelligent he is, and how it seems so far in the early going, how he's relating to the players, the practice clips, and everything else, there's a foundation being laid, and the evidence is on there through 4 games and through preseason that bodes well for the Lakers. And the Suns also made a coaching change as well with Mike Budenholzer. Similar type of thing. They wanted a better system. They wanted to play with more purpose. They wanted to have to take advantage of their personnel. The difference is the Lakers didn't make a ton of personnel changes. The Suns did. They bring in Tyus Jones as their point guard, totally different from their offense last year where it was point guard by committee. During the preseason, Vogel had talked about how Devin Booker is going to be their point guard. Well, now they get the truest point guard starting really maybe for any team right now besides old man Chris Paul with the Spurs. Tyus Jones has led the NBA in assist to turnover ratio for 3 years in a row. They change their bench. They draft Ryan Dunn, who as a rookie, I mean, Ryan Dunn tonight, Dumbin. Like he was awesome tonight. The block on LeBron as a help defender. Awesome. Locked him up multiple times on ball. Ryan Dunn, rookie, 27th pick. He does not look like a rookie at all. He looks like a star 3-and-D guy who should be getting paid $25 million a year right now.
No, I was really, really impressed by him. And, you know, I'm in the Laker chats during the game and everybody's like, man, that guy's nice. That guy's really nice. And you can tell when, as an opponent, when you face somebody like that, you're like, man, this guy's really nice. I have a question for you on Phoenix, though. I have very few rigid basketball beliefs. One of them is no rim pressure, no playoff success. That's just what I believe. How is Phoenix generating rim pressure? Because there was tonight where there were multiple possessions where there was good movement from Phoenix, but ultimately it was a lot of perimeter ping pong is what I call it. Like perimeter ping pong leading to good shots. I mean, when you have Bradley Beal, Devin Booker, Kevin Durant, willing and able to, you know, cycle through and pass and run through some kind of offense, those are still perimeter shots. I thought that Devin Booker got to the hole pretty nicely, but I don't think they commit to that kind of play. Do you worry about that? Or is that just me sticking to like an old school belief?
I mean, I worry a little bit. I think it'd be nice to have. I think that amount of variety that teams can have, like I think with Boston, if you look at their numbers, it's not like they're leading the league in drives into the paint per game, but they're leading the league in terms of quality drives in within the three-point line leading to quality kickouts. With the Suns, they just don't get to the paint really much at all. Yeah. But I do think with them, the difference is Tyus Jones and how they can add another guy who can help run high pick and roll, another guy who can play set up with the offense, and who even if he does get to the paint, he's not looking to score, but he can weasel his way into the paint looking to pass. And so I think with Phoenix, one of the things that would help them, and I don't know if this option is going to be there at all during the season, but finding somebody better than Yusuf Nurkić who can help add that vertical gravity, the vertical pressure, putting that on the rim. Nurkić does not do that. He's more of that connective piece as a playmaker, and so isn't their rookie center they drafted in the second round, Oso Iguodaro. He didn't play tonight against the Lakers, but I think he's another guy as a center. He's more of just that connective piece. So they don't really have a center that adds some of that pressure from the center position as a screener and roller. I think that'd be nice to have for them if they're able to find that. And by the way, Mason Plumlee doesn't have it either, but he had 10 rebounds tonight. He had a big one down the stretch, but he's not that guy either. So I think for the Suns, if they can get it from the center spot, because you're not going to suddenly change KD and Beal and Booker, and those guys are who they are at this stage of their careers, I do think that's a little bit of concern for them. Whereas for the Thunder, the favorite right now in the West, SGA gets to the line at will. Jalen Williams is becoming more of that player. Anthony Edwards with Minnesota, talk about him later with Dane Moore, gets to the basket. Luka gets to the basket. All of these teams in the West, and then opponents in the East, same thing. Like Boston can get to the line a little bit more often, or get to the paint more often. Philly, which
Jalen, when Jalen is attacking like that, I mean, they're already, I mean, as a Laker fan, they annoy the hell out of me this year because they just look so good. But Jalen can get to the rim. Jason Tatum can get to the rim. Derek White drives to the rim a lot. Like, so these guys, like, it's missing from Phoenix in a way that I think that just hurts their ceiling. But I don't know. They're amazing, obviously. The three players are amazing, but...
But they're not the upper echelon of the West. And it seems like neither are the Nuggets. The Nuggets got their first win tonight. They eked it out in overtime against the Raptors, 127-125. Look, man, Jokic, he ends up with 40 points. He's a guy who can add that interior pressure. He can do it all on the floor. He had 41 points in their second game after the opening night game, the loss last week, 16 points on 13 shots. It feels like with Denver, Jokic is going to have a lot more of these 40-point bangers for the Nuggets, not just the win games, but the stay-in games, because that supporting cast for Denver has fallen off a cliff. Jamal Murray hit the big layup at the end of the game, but Michael Porter Jr. has not offered them what you expect for the money he makes. Jamal Murray looks like he's continued to regress even more. I'm sure the Canadians up in Toronto watching that game tonight saw that as well after his, you know, stinkers for Team Canada in the Olympics earlier this year. Jokic is going to have to do this way more often this season, score more than he ever has, I'd say, for Denver.
He should not need to, right? He should not need to play 40 minutes and score 40 points just to beat the Raptors this season. Is it time for us to have the Russell Westbrook discussion? I feel like the last time I looked this up, we went way back in the Void days, the old KOC days. We had a discussion about Russell Westbrook on my team, the Lakers.
Yes.
And it's so interesting now, having after the Lakers experience, watching Russ with the Clippers and Russ with the Nuggets. And I want, you know, there's a lot of people who dunk on Russ and the lowlights and all that stuff. By the way, myself included. But I think that there's a really
interesting... Me too on Monday mornings. Scheduled posts.
The thing is, if we really analyze these situations, there's a really interesting through line between them. And first of all, I think... just there's often analysis that people do is just like, oh, these guys are stupid. I think that's bad analysis. I think you got
to
really
look at these guys being the stars in the teams, but giving him more chances over and over despite failure after failure.
Right. And including the people running the team. These guys know more about basketball than me, certainly. Right. So I can't look at them and say, why are you guys so stupid and not seeing this? So when LeBron James wanted Russell Westbrook, what was the circumstance of that time? The Lakers had won the championship in the bubble. There was that short turnaround to the 2021 season. LeBron had his worst injury of his career at that point. He lost most of the season. And it was a drag for every team that went to the bubble. They had a really bad year because there was such a short offseason. Everything was just so condensed and crammed. And so you're looking at LeBron James, who just had a really bad injury. So he's maybe sensing his mortality for the first time. He's looking around at a supporting cast and saying, listen, guys, I can't carry everybody anymore. I need a spark. I need somebody to carry us and lead us and be that nightly charge. And he identified Russell Westbrook as that guy because in his mind, I'm guessing, and it seems like that's what the reporting was, I need somebody else to do this with me. And I want that MVP who, you know, is just a blur in transition and he can get triple doubles for us and in the regular season and keep that going. Obviously a horrible idea. One of the worst, you know, for somebody with that IQ, it's just one of the worst ideas.
But, set him back.
Right. But if you want to understand where he's coming from, that's where he was coming from.
Yes.
The Clippers were the next team that Russ went to. And Paul George was one of the reasons, one of the big recruiters of Russell Westbrook. But the Clippers also really liked the idea because they too, a team kind of devoid of leadership in the locker room, right? Paul George and Kawhi are great players, but that's not, they're not natural leaders. And they always hit the same ceiling. So they probably look at Russ as somebody, hey, we've kind of hit a wall. We can't get over the top. Paul George and Kawhi might see him and say, hey, this guy can take a lot of the load during the regular season. Former MVP, you know, all that stuff, triple doubles, let's bring him on.
Two guys now, that miss a lot of time, help them alleviate, you know, if they have to miss absolutely. Time due to injury, rest,
he's always
the
available.
Reason.
He's yes. always ready to go. He's always, his athleticism is still par, like just yes. really high top end. And so now, Denver, Jokic, a player like Jokic saying, I want Russell Westbrook is so, when I heard it first, I'm like, where is this coming from? How is Jokic of all people seeing this? But Denver hit a wall. Jamal Murray didn't look like himself. Michael Porter Jr., even Aaron Gordon. Aaron Gordon was awesome in the playoffs, but still, it's just like Jokic had to carry such a load and they still ran into a wall. They couldn't get past Minnesota. They lost that game 7. And so I look at him and saying, he might be saying, hey man, I can't carry this team. And if Jamal Murray is going to look like this, and if Michael Porter Jr. can't get to that proper, you know, upper tier echelon that we paid him to be, well, get me Russell Westbrook, get me that triple double guy. And there's a common pattern here where a contending type team, either that's won already, like the Lakers and the Nuggets or the Clippers who fancy themselves a contender, are looking at like, hey, we need somebody to get us through a regular season because right
God,
now we're
you
not
sound
cutting
like
it.
Such a Lakers fan.
I know,
fancy themselves
right?
a contender.
But I'm telling you, man, there's something to this that it goes deeper and it speaks to me that Denver, whether they're explicitly or implicitly seeing this or Jokic is explicitly or implicitly feeling this, like this is end of empire stuff. This is end of title window stuff. And maybe this is just what the window is. The Nuggets had injury trouble, right? Jamal Murray was hurt one season and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so maybe this is just what the title windows are. And, you know, we're going to talk about the Bucks later. Like maybe these are just what the windows are. And if you lose a season to an injury, hey man, sorry, that's what happens, but that's still a tight window. And maybe Russell Westbrook in all three cases with the Lakers, with the Clippers, and maybe the Nuggets too represents, hey, this is the end of the run for this group.
It's a smart
that's my
observation.
That's my grand unified Russell Westbrook theory.
In a way, it's understandable. Yes. Like you look at Russell Westbrook and you're like, how could Russ not provide us a spark? That's always yep. what he's been. He's always been that guy. Yep. Even with the Wizards and the Rockets, he had yep. some moments. There were some moments and stretches where you're like, we could get that out of Russ. I'm LeBron. I'm Kawhi. Yeah. I'm the Joker. I'm a multiple time
MVP. I'm Michael Malone.
MVP.
I'm sure Michael yeah, Malone wants
I
it too.
I know. Exactly. So, especially after, in the case of Denver, Lakers lost guys too in free agency. The Nuggets in consecutive years, they lose Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. They lose Bruce Brown the year prior. And in the game tonight, you see Bruce Brown out there for the Raptors. I'm sure that it was a sour thing for Nuggets fans to see. That's
future
part of
Laker.
It too. Yeah. Could be a future Laker. Yeah. Flip D'Lo for him. That'd be a nice fit for the Lakers, right? That makes
listening.
Some sense. Yeah, that's a good idea. D'Lo's the weak link for the Lakers, I think. I like D'Lo personally. Like, you know, nice, seems like a nice guy. He's a fun player individually, but not the guy for the Lakers. Anyway, the Nuggets. I do think there are a lot of signs that this is the end of the empire for them. Later in the conversation with Dane Moore, one of the things that we talk about is how Minnesota, everybody talked about they're built to beat Denver. They had all these wings last year, big bigs last year, Gobert, Karl Anthony Towns, Nasri. They constructed their team to beat Denver. But then they trade Karl Anthony Towns and they have a bunch of long-armed wings because Denver's really the one team right now in the West where it's like you gotta have a big to beat Jokic. But in reality, the Mavericks have Luka. The Suns have a bunch of wings. The Lakers still have LeBron. You get the Timberwolves with Anthony Edwards. You have a bunch of teams with wings. The Celtics out East, wings. These big wings.
OKC.
OKC with SGA, Jalen Williams. So I think with Denver, that is what they lack. They have Aaron Gordon for defense. MPJ is solid defensively, but he's not that guy.
Very polite, if you say.
He's okay. He's fine. He went from bad negative defender to respectable.
Yeah.
Solid. I'll give him that. Christian Brown, who's been probably the second best player for the Nuggets this year. He don't want Christian Brown to be your second best player. That's a bad sign for you. And I think for Denver, like we talk about wings, but there's also depth. Minnesota, loaded with depth. Boston, loaded with depth. OKC has more good players than they're able to play. There's so many teams with great depth. I think even if the Lakers get healthy, they have pretty good depth. Meanwhile, Denver tonight, even though it goes to overtime, Jokic 44 minutes, Gordon 42 minutes, Murray and Brown 40 minutes, MPJ 39 minutes to beat a bad Raptors team in the third game of the season. It's just the same thing as last year when Malone was playing the starters so many minutes and they just ran out of steam in the playoffs, except I think it's going to be even worse this year for them. And for Denver, it's just really, really scary to be in the place that they are right now because Jokic individually is still absolutely brilliant. He is still an unbelievable talent. He is still an MVP caliber guy. And if he were to drag this team to like a 3 seed or a 4 seed or even a 5 seed, he's going to get MVP votes. He might not win it, but he would get some votes.
That's Anthony Davis's award this year.
I mean, AD does look like an MVP candidate right now, but it does feel like potential end of empire stuff for the Nuggets. Would you still, like, yes or no, would you classify the Nuggets still as a contender this year, even if it's just a 1% chance? Or are they out?
So I have enough respect for Jokic to where I would say, yeah, they have a very, very, very small puncher's chance. I mean, there's a combination of Jokic himself. I think the chemistry he has with Aaron Gordon in those crunch time plays. And Jamal Murray, I mean, he just dropped 2 game winners on me last playoffs. I can't completely write him off. But what it'll take them to get through a regular season in this Western Conference, in this NBA overall, which is pretty loaded, you know, there's not like a lot of horrible, horrible teams. I mean, if they can't get, you know, they need to expend this much energy to get past Toronto. I will give them fringe contender status only because out of deference to Jokic, but I don't fear them in a way that the Lakers lost to them last 2 playoffs. I should fear them. I don't. Yeah, I just give me more Russell Westbrook minutes. See, I can be snarky now. I was nice before, but I can be snarky now.
I think fringe contender status is appropriate, and Russell Westbrook on the season is shooting 20% from the field. Let's talk about a guy or a team that the Nuggets lost a guy to. KCP goes to the Magic. Tonight, Franz Wagner out with an illness earlier in the game. And then Paolo Banchero drops 37 in the first half, ends the game with 50 bomb. A 50 bomb. Paolo Banchero scoring from all over the floor, doing absolutely everything, bullying players on drives to the rim, hitting pull-ups, hitting threes. Banchero looked like a guy that's taking the leap right now, I'd say, Domin.
I got to say, I was so impressed with him when he was with Team USA. That was a miserable team, but he was one of the guys I was just like, man, this guy's got like way more fight and way more. There's a different level to his game that I see, and it has translated so well into what he's doing this season. What does he do? I'm curious because when we look at teams in the East and how things have shaken kind of now, where do you put Orlando's ceiling now? Because Franz also, by the way, you know, injury, illness aside, he's been really good too, and he struggled last season, but he's come out this season looking really good.
And even with KCP, he really hasn't done anything offensively for Orlando yet, but he's adding a lot defensively. Anthony Black hit the huge three down the stretch for the Magic tonight. Like, they're young guys. Jalen Suggs continues getting better.
I love Jalen Suggs. Wendell
Carter, just a steady, rock solid center, inhales everything.
Jonathan
as a rebounder.
Isaac is like their seventh man or whatever. It's just outrageous.
And he's one of the best defenders in basketball. Right now he's sidelined, but you know, once Isaac gets back, you have one of the best defensive players in basketball being added to your team. So they are deep with quality talent. They have great top end talent. Bankero looks like he's ascending to a guy that's going to be in the all NBA conversation, or maybe a lock for all NBA teams if he has more games like he did on Monday night. So I think for the Magic, you know, on last Monday's episode, I believe it was, Legend of Winning said that he had the Magic as a top three seed in the Eastern Conference.
Yep.
I think that's fair. I really do think that's a fair expectation or hope for Orlando, because in my eyes, they've surpassed the Heat as the best team in Florida. The Celtics are still the best team in the East. Cleveland's going to be an awesome regular season team. They're still 4-0. Got another win tonight, by the way. Garland had a big game for them.
Yep.
The Knicks, I think they could have a better record than the Magic, but it's not a certainty. The Sixers have guys in and out of the lineup all the time. And the Bucks, who we'll talk about in the second, might be time to press the panic switch there. So for the Magic, they're going to have an elite defense. Their offense looks much, much better. They're shooting more threes and shooting more effective threes.
That was the question, right? Their offensive ceiling was always, even last year, I mean, they had nights where they looked awesome, but the offensive ceiling was always the question.
Much more consistent now. So I'd say top three in the East for the Magic, and the Bucks could be one of those teams that they're surpassing. The Bucks tonight, man, they lose to the Nets, to Cam Thomas, who might finish top five or top 10 in scoring. Cam Thomas is awesome, but no disrespect to the Nets. They stink, and yet the Bucks lose to them in Milwaukee, 115-102 on Sunday. And then on Monday, back-to-back, Celtics and Bucks pretty close for the first half. Celtics run away with it in the second half, 119-108 on Monday night. Now on the season, the Bucks, 1-3 start, 13th in offensive rating, 25th in defensive rating. And Domin, I felt like watching Celtics-Bucks tonight, the disparity in depth of talent. You have on the Boston side, Peyton Pritchard just going off. He's one of the best backup point guards in the NBA. Luke Kornet offering 10 solid minutes as one of the better backup centers in the NBA. Whereas on the Bucks, he's a bigger name, but Bobby Portis chucking, ball stopping, not boxing out. It is so sickening watching Bobby Portis on this Bucks team, where sometimes he'll give you 10 minutes or a quarter where he just goes off and he hits everything. But then it's these long, week, multi-week stretches where he gives you nothing. And the Bucks, I think a lot of people this year, they're going to blame Doc Rivers. Doc is going to be such an easy target. Mr. Blown 3-1 lead. He takes no accountability ever at the podium. He never defends his put. He never takes it. He never says it's my fault, ever. He's going to get blamed. But to me, this is on the Bucks front office if this continues to go sour. It's on John Horst and the Bucks front office, because they've whiffed on too many draft picks. Marjon Beauchamp looking like a bust. They've selected raw prospects who are nowhere near ready, like AJ Johnson, when they could have drafted somebody like Ryan Dunn, who Phoenix got at 28. Yeah. And then he was the one who hired Adrian Griffin and then hired Doc Rivers. Doc Rivers, who everybody knows, doesn't develop young players. He doesn't like to play young players. And so even though the one young guy that you have with some promise on Andre Jackson, Doc barely throws him out there. He got a couple of minutes tonight for the Bucks, and he looks solid, but he's not going to necessarily get minutes again their next game. So to me, you still have Giannis playing at an elite level. Damian Lillard looking far more healthy now. Doc's going to get the blame, but to me, this is more of an organization-wide fault, and it's largely on that front office failing to surround Giannis with the proper pieces to help him maintain contention. And at this point, I have a hard time saying that they're still a contender, unless it's just out of respect for Giannis, like you said, in regards to Jokic, and that's it.
I think that there's some parallels here between their situations, right? First of all, I have a project for Tom Haberstroh. Can he track Peyton Pritchard's like end of quarter shots? I feel like he's shooting like true shooting 99% or something like that. It's out of control.
I mean, he's a legend. He's the greatest end of quarter
shooter
ever. It's
outrageous.
I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but I know some Celtics beat writers have tracked it before or posted. I'll see if I can find it, but it's like ridiculous numbers. And obviously he had the moment in the finals too that everybody's always going to remember. But yeah, Peyton Pritchard, that dude is, I mean, he's a great backup point guard, man.
It's so annoying. So the Bucks probably are my number one disappointment this season because all the recipes.
Torian Prince, yes.
Look, I swear, even with Chris Middleton being out, I looked at them as a team that had all the recipes for a big, like, FU comeback season. Just last year, everybody dumped on us. We're not on Christmas. All this stuff. Like, we're ready to go. Us versus the world. And the way they've come out has not only been disappointing, it's been, like, really, really, really alarming to the point where I would always say, hey, we're not even at Halloween yet. Why are we panicking? To go back to the way we talked about the Lakers and their mindset and the professionalism and their compete every night, whether they win or lose, there's probably like the Lakers are in their current form. They're not quite into like strong contender status. They're probably right under it. There's some changes they need, they can make. There's some depth issues on the bench. I don't know. I don't trust their bench scoring, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't question their night to night fight and the professionalism in their organization. I'm worried about it all with Milwaukee at this point because I can never imagine having multiple games this season already where I look at them and being like, why aren't you guys caring enough about tonight? And that's a team led by Giannis, like who's one of one, like psycho competitor. So something is off about this mix of people. And to your point about the front office, so the draft pick point is a great one. And I can't argue against it. You know, you're the draft guy, first of all, but also the proof is in the pudding where we're looking at that they really haven't had a young player emerge. And I think that one of the keys in the NBA now, if you're a contending team and you're, you know, you're really into the repeater and all that, you need that young talent to replenish consistently.
Which but Boston also, has gone. Peyton Pritchard, he just finished up his rookie contract, but he was a contributor for four
again,
straight years
Celtics,
in the postseason.
So keep doing this. Yes. How dare you?
Yes. I mean, you get Luke Kornet, Sam Hauser, who didn't play on Monday night. That's like up and down the line. They've nailed it with their young guys off the bench.
It is so annoying that Brad Stevens turned out this good as an executive. He's unbelievable. It pisses me off so much.
And by the way, Jordan Walsh could end up really good as well. So they have a lot of guys.
Oh, Kevin O'Celtics back. I love how they hate you and you're out here defending them. The fans hate you.
And I'm honest. I was wrong about the Celtics last year. I was wrong, but at least I'm always honest about how I feel about the team. So,
but I look at a team like Milwaukee and I alluded to this with Denver, and I just wonder if there's a natural life cycle to contention in 2024 in just the way the CBAs are structured, especially if you don't hit on draft picks to where now it's a, hey, maybe this just isn't meant to be and we have to look at what's next. This actually happens in the NFL quite a bit. You, as a fan of the Patriots, especially growing up, the way Belichick, that's what he would do, right? The team would get kind of older. There'd be veterans who need to get paid and he'd recycle and reshuffle what from the outside looked like prematurely. Like, hey, you didn't need to trade
Richard Seymour. Yes, that's
right.
The big one.
You didn't
one.
Need to trade these guys, but you did. You got younger pieces back, you got draft picks back, and you replenished that way, and you kept your contention window longer. And I wonder if Denver is going to come to a similar conclusion, and I wonder if the Bucks might come to a similar conclusion where it's not necessarily a full teardown, but you trust your central star enough, like a Giannis, you trust a Jokic, and you look at Giannis, you say, okay, Giannis, this is not going to work. This is our plan. We're going to trade Brook Lopez. We're going to shop Bobby Portis. We're going to trade Dame in the offseason. Look, hey, we tried. It didn't work. We still defend the trade. Our team hit an offensive ceiling. We had to trade for Dame Lillard. This was our last shot. And we're going to bring in fresh pieces. We're going to trade Brook Lopez to Houston and get a couple of their young pieces. And we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And maybe that is what it looks like when you're at the tail end of a contention window to extend that is to prematurely shuffle some of your pieces. And I think we're going to find that out pretty soon managing the CBA and see what like Boston does and all these teams do moving forward. That's kind of the way I've been approaching it because I don't see how this gets better. It's not going to just a month from now, it's not going to look miraculously better.
They don't have assets. They don't have young guys with value. All their only hope really is that Chris Middleton comes back and looks like the Chris Middleton that people imagine as a playoff hero.
I love
hero.
Chris Middleton, man. Me too. It's
unrealistic.
It's unrealistic, yeah.
It's unrealistic to expect. I mean, they're also a super old team. So yes. Tonight on X, I put up a poll and I asked simply, has the championship window shut for the Bucks. And as of recording right now, 11,947 votes. 79.7% of people voted yes. And a couple of the replies, Rangers Boy said, I wouldn't be shocked if Giannis decides to flee Milwaukee at some point in his career. Iron, big Warzone streamer, Iron said, I'd say yes, but after the Raptors championship with injuries that happened, I'd say anything is possible. And then Gary Goodrich said, with Doc coaching, yes. I think Iron is right here, that you got to keep it open just a little sliver, just a crack, because crazier things have happened. If they slip into the postseason, who really knows? Like, you can make a run. You never know. But it's
that's really why I don't advocate fast. That's why I don't advocate for a teardown. I advocate for a shuffle. And you have Giannis with some fresh pieces. And you say, Giannis, we believe in you so much. We think you can take these guys to the championship.
But will he be patient there? Would he want to be patient there? Or is he going to say, huh, OKC could trade all their picks for me and I could go win like five finals? Huh.
So here's what I'll push back on you on. Here's what I'll push back on you on. I think, again, this is a working theory. I think that that five championship thing is out the window for every team in the NBA, the way it's currently structured. And so even if OKC were to do that, their window is smaller than we think. And I think that across the board, OKC is a unique situation. But
if they traded 10 first, they'd still have seven left over.
No, no, they're an exception. No, you're right. You're right. That's OKC is a freak show. Yeah.
They are. They really are a freak show for that reason.
Everybody
even says like, oh, Wemby's coming. The Spurs are coming. The Spurs have a long way to go with building that team out around Wemby. The Thunder are the team that are here and they're still coming. They could still get even better. And so I'm not saying that Giannis should necessarily do that, but I'm saying he should at least be thinking about it when he's talking about his wife and pondering his future. That's all.
Speaking of Wemby, or Bon Bonner, as I've been jokingly calling him.
So disrespectful.
He needs to... I was expecting a little bit more from him than early this season, man. I'm not seeing it.
What are some of your other Wemby nicknames? You've got a few of them we've texted about.
Oh, yeah. I had Digestif Diop. So bad.
Oh, my God. What a hater.
Croissant Cantor. Bouillon Bobo.
That's so good. Well, those nicknames are looking pretty solid with his start to the season. Wemby has not looked like the megastar GOAT that was promised in his second year. But
Chet might be coming for his corner, man.
Nah, it's ridiculous. it's insane. If you put Wemby on OKC.
USA.
If you put Wemby on OKC, it would be pretty clear Wemby is the better player with that supporting cast.
Fair enough.
But the Spurs have a long way to go. Yeah. Dumbin, I appreciate you joining me on tonight's show, man.
Oh, dude, so fun. I've loved everything you're doing, Yahoo. I'm really excited for where the podcast is going.
Thank you, Dumbin. Next up, talking Timberwolves with Dane Moore, an incredible basketball analyst, host of the Dane Moore NBA podcast. That's coming up next. All right, Dane. So the Wolves are taking half of their shots from three so far this season, behind only Boston. They're 17th in three-point rate last year, so one of the biggest rises so far in the league. Anthony Edwards last season was taking about a little over a third of his threes. This year, he's taken 70 total shots. 40 of them have been three-pointers. Half their shots from Minnesota so far are coming from three. What the hell is going on with the Wolves, Dan?
This is totally different. Guess how many times last season they shot more threes than twos in a single game? Guess how many times they did that?
Well, if they were, I think, like 34-35% last season. So I don't know. Let's give it seven times last year.
One time.
Wow.
Yes, it was against Dallas in some point during the season against Dallas, and that was the only time. I don't know, maybe they're probably just trying to keep up with Dallas there. So this is like, yeah, there's the Ant part of it that's different, and he's shooting a lot more, and it's looking like that's going to stick. But I think the bigger part of it is just a team that has a greater commitment to shooting the three-point shot is just going to change systemically how this thing looks and feels. I think everybody, you know, the making the like Julius Randle to pass to Ant jokes, you know, like who's going to stop the ball more than the other. Like, I think it's shaping up like this team is going to stop the ball less than a season ago. I don't even think that's a cat thing. It's just they didn't spread the floor with intention last season. And Chris Finch has always been a little reticent to be a spread pick and roll team. You know, he wants to play in the flow. But now with this roster construction, you bring in Randle, who shoots just as many threes as Carl, even if he doesn't make as many. You bring in Dante DiVincenzo, who's like Steph light on volume. I mean, this team's just going to shoot way more threes. And I think as we get into the season, it's going to feel a lot different than the Wolves team we got used to last year.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, it looks different too. I mean, like the amount of off-ball screening and cutting and movement and motion the last two games. Like I thought opening night against the Lakers, it looked a little bit clunky offensively, but last two games, especially that Toronto game, I felt like the offense more resembled what Minnesota wants to look like. Did you kind of see, do you see this team getting more comfortable with what Finch wants this team to look like offensively?
Yeah, well, it's a product of like getting everyone to play the way that Finch wants to play, which is he wants ball movement. Like that's the whole thing. We always say like the Finchian flow, right? He says
changing
flow,
side
flow.
To side.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I think in that first Lakers game you're referencing, like Randle understandably is like, what do I do? You know, he did not have a good feel for what his position was because it's hard to come into a team. I think it's probably really hard to come into a team and be the number two because that's like a, that's still a lot of shot volume and creation that's expected out of you. And he kind of like tiptoed his way into that and was figuring it out. Then was really helped in the Sacramento game, the second game of the season, where he just got hot. And that just kind of settled him into what, you know, what I think this role is going to look like. And then, you know, Toronto, that game was a joke. That team already... That was like a March game or something where, you know, like I've seen a lot of those over the years. So it wasn't great competition, but I was really encouraged by the first 6 minutes of that game against Toronto where it was like, all right, Julius is going, gap help is in, one pass, there's Ant shoots it. You know, invert that the other way if it's Ant. There was like a decisiveness of not over pursuing their own individual shot and finding the outlet off of that once the defense came and Ant was making those and finding kicks to Conley who started hitting threes. Like it just, you can't hold for too long. Otherwise flow flops. And I think that's what we've experienced a lot of these last 2 years. Cause the Wolves have been a bad offensive team, you know, in the Gobert era, like, and now it's theoretically changing.
The decisiveness you talk about is definitely what's apparent to me. Well, like it's a lot of quick decisions. And like with Julius Randle, for years it's been ball stopper, record scratches the offense. It's frustrating to watch. And with Ant, even to this day, it's still, well, what level can he reach as a playmaker? Like that's still a question, I think, at the highest levels. And Tuesday night, the rematch against the Dallas Mavericks will be a really good test there. Can Ant, when Dallas is, you know, slowing down some of those off-ball actions when they're using their length and versatility and those off-ball screens, the pin downs and for coming on the side of the court are not as effective for Minnesota. How does Ant elevate? I think those will still be questions, but the decisiveness from the collective group, it seems to me from the outsider's perspective that this is clearly the intentions of Tim Conley in the front office and Chris Finch, head coach. Chris Finch, who famously was the head coach of the Houston Rockets G League team when they started jacking up 100 threes a game before the Houston Rockets were doing it. Daryl Morey wanted to use the G League to experiment with that. Finch was the coach there then. It seems to me that there's an organizational alignment from front office with the changes that they've made in the offseason to head coach with the way in which the team is performing, to star player Anthony Edwards taking 40 of his 70 shots from three. Is that accurate to say? Like, this is more of an organizational thing?
No, I don't think so, Kevin. That makes it sound too, like, dogmatic. Like, there is a requirement or... Because there was. When you reference in the Houston stuff, right? Like, I mean, we remember that watching the Rockets where it was like... It almost felt like there was a line. It's like, we're getting over this.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's not like that. It's about like upping the intention of 3-point volume, I think, without making a requirement. And I think it feels like a requirement and the numbers seem so crazy because Ant has turned it up. Like that.
It really
that's
does.
What,
it does.
It does. I know Finch. Like he is just, I've never talked to him about this like specifically, but I think he got a little bogged down by the whole Houston Harden experience, because he then went and was on their bench, and he was one of the assistants with those Houston teams. And when it was too much of the same thing over and over again, I think Finch, in that experience, it got him to change his mind and like draw an outline of what it looks like, but don't require it to be the way. And then it becomes a little bit less of a science project and more like art. And I think that's what Finch is going for. Sometimes the opposite here, man, like, all right, a little bit more structure might help a little bit. Like, you got Rudy Gobert. Like, how was Utah so good? Like, that's when it's bad with the Wolves offense. That's what I always go back to. But Finch has held on to this vision for sure since he's been here.
Now, I mean, I think with Finch, I believe that. I think like maybe it is more of guideline than, you know, mandated structure, as you said. With Ant, it's interesting to me with him specifically because like he kind of fell to a little over a third of his shots were from three in the last 2 years. Earlier in his career, it was over 40%. Like, he was a kind of a higher volume guy from three. Has he always wanted to be one of these very high volume 3-point shooters? Has there been an indication from him, anything he said about like, hey, I'm going to shoot a hell of a lot of threes this year and I'm not going to stop? Because you said earlier, you don't think it's going to go away. You think this is going to continue?
I think it's new though, Kevin. I think a lot of it was playing with Steph this summer. He's talked a lot to us in training camp about like the idea of being moving without the ball and repositioning. And I know where Finch wants his volume to uptick from three is in the catch and shoot opportunities.
That's a good thing. Much better off the catch than off the dribble. Always has been. Since he was a rookie, he was better at it.
Yeah. Well, and welcome to basketball. That's just like, you would be too, you know, like
those are easier
shots to take. I think part of it is though too, I think he tweaked his mechanics a good amount. Like, he always kind of had one of those like raise up and then it was like a two-part mechanic at the top of the jumper, and that's less pronounced now. And it really, just sitting there, you know, like watching a pregame or at practice or whatever, there's a lot more like zip on the shot. So I think it's less so like Ant has always wanted this. I think it's classic Ant, and he's like, found something that works. I'm going to do like more of that. He's learning as he goes in this whole process while becoming a better 3-point shooter. So yeah, I think he's going to shoot more. There is a delicate balance though here too. Like, it was kind of driving me crazy in the first half of the matchup against the Kings. Like, it's Sabonis at the rim, man. Like, what, we're shooting like 8 threes and you got to the rim twice. You know, there's a balance, and you're going to figure that out over the course of the year. But I don't know. I don't think Ant has, honestly, earlier in his career, I think he wanted to be a mid-range guy and, you know, Kobe. And I think Finch has been working with him to not delete that, because we know that's an important part of the game too, but to, again, a guideline of not prioritizing it.
I think that makes sense. It's and for him, that Sacramento game's a good example. Or sometimes it's like, really? Like, what are you doing? Like, why not drive to the rim, attack the rim? And that, I think over the course of the season, that's where...
I mean, they were blitzing him, you know? Yes, like, so I get it a little bit. And, man, we should talk about Rudy a little bit, too. Like, Rudy on the short roll, when they're blitzing him and that, like, Rudy's looks like he's got something there, man. Mm-hmm, so it's all a balance. It's matchup dependent. Like, I caught myself, you know, like tweeting during the game, like, why isn't Ant going to the basket? And then at halftime I go back and like look at the coverages. I'm like, all right, you know, you're getting blitzed every time. He's getting doubled. Like, context is always important in shot selection.
Of course. Well, how have you seen Anthony Edwards' growth on as a playmaker, and in what ways do you think he needs to continue improving over the course of the season? Because you're talking about the scoring balance. How does his playmaking still need to improve? Where are the holes?
It's been the coolest thing to track, because honestly, he wasn't good at it. It just was not a strong playmaker. Like, honestly, even up to the trade deadline last year. And it flipped in that Phoenix series, man. Like, it was crazy how they guarded Ant. It wasn't just gap help, like, on the way he was going. Like, they brought in two guys. It was like a triangle at the top of the key, like double gap help. They're like, you're not getting in here. You know, like, you got to get off of it. And Ant did, man. It's why they swept the Suns. It was the first real level up I'd seen from Ant, who, you know, even a year prior to that was just so flummoxed by like seeing two. So he figured out just the basic part of like, they're putting two here, I'm getting off of it. And even you referenced that Kings game. If you watch at the very end of it, they bring De'Aaron Fox over for the double. Ant, it's a simple thing. De'Aaron Fox is leaving Mike Conley, right? Hits Mike Conley, sprints to Mike Conley. Mike Conley hands off to him. Ant attacks the basket against a shifted defense, fouled two free throws. They win the game. That was not in his game a year ago, man. And it is now. And I don't want to get like greedy with it, but the next level, and if we want to talk about like the Wolves going to the championship, Ant being an MVP candidate, can he do another level of playmaking on that where he's thinking, all right, I'm going to this spot to trick the defense to think that I am the scoring option here, but really my intention is pulling the defender away. So now Jaden's wide open in the corner. Nas is here on the cut, whatever it might be. And that's when it gets scary. If he starts sneaking the game like that,
does he have to get to that level, Dame? Like, is that necessary for the Wolves to win a championship?
Yes.
You think so?
100%.
Okay.
I think
so. They can't get enough playmaking from DiVincenzo, Mike Conley, Julius Randle. It can't be by committee. You think Anthony Edwards has to get to that point?
To win the championship, I think he needs to get to the point where he's playing 3D chess as a playmaker sometime, the way that Luka does, the way Shea does, the way that those guys do. Like,
can he do that this season, though? 23 years old still. He's still super young. It's easy to forget Anthony Edwards is still only 23 years old. Can this season
happen? We got 79 games, man. Yeah. 79 games. Let's see. I'm not doubting it. That is a very difficult thing to do for Anthony Edwards, who used to play basketball nothing like Luka Doncic, for us to be asking him to be thinking and manipulating the game like Luka Doncic. Yeah, and if he can do that with his athletic package, then I think the Wolves are a true championship contender. But it should be a high bar. Like, for any team, if me and you are like, oh, do we think the Knicks can be a championship contender? We better be asking a lot of Karl Anthony Towns, of OG Anunoby, all that stuff. Like, this is the a lot that they have to ask out of Anthony Edwards. And in my opinion, yeah, sure. I've been really impressed by Dante as a playmaker since he's got here. I think Nas can play make some. I don't think in today's NBA, but and particularly in the playoffs, that you can play make by committee into a championship. I just don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, I think even with Boston, like, they do it by committee in the sense that everybody on the floor at times can play make in different ways, like all five guys can. And I think Minnesota, that's ultimately what the goal is, where everybody can make a pass, everybody can play make in their own respective ways. DiVincenzo running a ton of pick and rolls in preseason for Minnesota, and he's always shown that he can do that throughout his career, but he's at more of it's being asked of him. And with Mike Conley at his age,
that's popped for me.
Yeah, it definitely has. And with Mike Conley at his age, I think that's going to be especially important. Is there a plan for the Wolves this year in games in which Conley's resting or is just simply out, where, you know, is Rob Dillingham going to play in those situations? Is DiVincenzo going to start? Like, what's the plan for Minnesota when Mike Conley's out?
Well, it's a funny thing with Mike where he played 76 games last year, dude. Mm-hmm. Like, and they wanted that, and he wanted that. He had a goal last season to play all 82. And he eventually sat one out. It was a weird, like, they got there. It was a back to back, and they had to fly into like Boston day of. And it was so he sat out a game and they kind of let it go. But he was so instrumental last season to playmaking and just being the adult with the ball in his hands that they needed that. I still think Mike hasn't played well in these first three games, no, but hasn't. I still think
not shooting well they at all need, so far.
No. And he's 37. I'm going to give it a little bit of time, you know, with him. I just trust his smarts and shooting ability at a minimum to kind of, you know, bring him back to his water level. But yeah, Mike Conley was also hurt in the Dallas series, and he wore down over the course of the season to some extent. So I do think you need to, if you're Mike, you got to go with a little bit more foresight. He said he likes playing in back-to-backs. Well, maybe is that where Finch needs to step in and be like, we're not doing that this year. Because
this young guy is deserving of developmental opportunities. I mean, Terrence Shannon, I think, like, he's just a rookie. In all likelihood, Terrence Shannon's not, like, as a late first-round pick, is not going to be a guy in the playoffs. But he's also a long-armed wing. He has versatility. He's a downhill attacker. I'd like to at least get those guys some developmental minutes, Dillingham, Terrence Shannon, over the course of the season. And just
Minot.
Find out what you have. Minot. Like, where's Josh Minot? He looked great in preseason.
Dude, this team is too deep, though. Like, yeah. Honestly, I did the same thing and was like, they're going to play a 10-man rotation. Like, they have to, you know, because, like, we were told on draft night by Tim Connolly, like, Dillingham's going to be in the rotation day one. And obviously, he was saying that before they made the cat trade and got DiVincenzo and got a little bit deeper, whatever. But we all had we all had Dillingham penned into the rotation, and then you know you make that trade, and they've been playing eight guys, and then Joe Ingles for like 5 minutes a night as the ninth. And Wolves fans, you know, want those 5 minutes to go to Dillingham or Minot or whatever. But I don't know, man. 6, 7, and 8, Nasri, Dante DiVincenzo, Nikhil Alexander Walker, like show me a better 6, 7, and 8 in the league. So you want to give those guys 20 minutes. I don't know where the room comes to give Rob Dillingham in particular the leash to, you know, to be able to get comfortable in a role. You can't give him the Joe Ingles 5 minutes a game role. That'd be such a weird way to enter an NBA rotation. I think Dillingham's
not enough
comes
to get a rhythm either. Like he needs to spend a run. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I just don't think if me and you sat down here and we're like, all right, dude, let's chop up these 240 minutes for the Wolves rotation, and we assigned number values to everybody. Like, if we made 10 lines to play 10 guys, we would be like, all right, okay, DiVincenzo 14. Like, that doesn't make sense. With this group as is, they kind of got to play it. And I don't think it's fine for Dillingham to wait a little bit. It's fine for Minot to, you know, if somebody gets hurt, somebody needs a night off, Jaden McDaniel rolls his ankle, great. You know, throw him into the mix. Maybe Terrence Shannon Jr. as a big wing. I'm curious to see if we see that at all against Dallas, right? They talked about Terrence Shannon Jr. in particular as being another big body to guard power wings, specifically referencing the Dallas series there. So it's depth. And depth is a good thing to have. And right now, in October, we forget that guys get hurt and then need necessitates some of this thing. I think it'll be fine. They'll get there. I just don't know how you can play Nasri, Dante DiVincenzo, and Nikhil Alexander Walker 20 plus minutes a night that they deserve while also playing Rob Dillingham, who comes with risk.
You use the phrasing power wing. I think that's interesting because it makes me think about Minnesota at the time of the Cat Randall DiVincenzo trade, where it's like, oh, can they beat Denver anymore? Can they match up against Jokic? Well, they still have Nasri. They still have Rudy Gobert. Randall's, you know, a brick house as well. He's strong. So in Denver, at least so far, it's early on, Denver looks like much less of a threat. So yeah, the threats are those teams with those go-to scoring wings. It's mm-hmm. like Dallas again with Luka. It's Phoenix maybe with KD and Devin Booker. It's if you get to the finals, it's Boston with Tatum and Brown. All these
Don't
teams
OKC.
Across the league. OKC, yeah. They may win 68 games. It's these teams with big ball handlers that you have to beat more so than maybe Denver. Like, it seems like Denver might not be the team you have to beat anymore. Minnesota right. also is now that team with a bunch of those, as you said, power wings. Mm-hmm. Pretty clearly to me, like, that was the objective with these trades, those moves. Like, they're less worried about focusing on beating Denver because they have those guys still. They still feel like they have those guys. And now it's about having better balance for everybody else in the league.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. Then that's what when we talked to Tim Connelly and general manager Matt Lloyd after the draft, the power wing was Matt Lloyd's words. Describing Terrence Shannon Jr. And he specifically named being able to guard Dallas. I don't know if you remember this, but like what Dallas tried to really attack in that series was Mike Conley. And they were trying to get, you know, either him on Kyrie or on Luka to kind of be able to go at. And the Wolves were trying to, you know, either hide that a little bit, you know, put him on a shooter. And Dallas just went double drag like all day. They're like, you're going to put it was right? It was crazy. Like they were like, Mike Conley, you are going to come up and guard Luka on this switch here. Or if you want to stay down there, then it's your job to tag, you know, Derek Lively or Daniel Gafford at the rim, and
good
they killed
luck.
It. Yeah, they killed it. They killed it. And like, actually, for a 6 foot guy, I think Mike Conley is like a really good 6 foot tall defender. But in that spot, he was a problem. And so now, is DiVincenzo at 6'4" big enough there? You know, we'll see. Tomorrow will be an interesting test for that. Or do you need to go even bigger when they play Dallas in the playoffs or even during the regular season? Do you need to have a Minot in there who can fight Lively on the lob there? Do you need to have a Terrence Shannon Jr.? Those are the bigger and maybe playoff questions once teams start really trying to poke at things. I think they'll probably try to poke at Randall a little bit too when the time comes. Again, good. That's why it's a good problem to have with depth and be able to see, you know, how is best for you to match up in this lineup. And they have the ability now, in theory, to have more big wings guarding more big wings.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Minnesota has more depth there. They have more different front court combinations that they can play. And I mean, early on so far this season, obviously we've seen all three of the combos. Gobert, Randall is starting, Naz Reid coming off the bench. I said before the season that I'd love to see Naz Reid starting at some point over Julius Randall. You know, but it looks good seeing him play with Randall as well. The combinations, you know, they've all.
Yeah, but let's talk about that. Okay. So like, you're Chris Finch. I'm Tim Connolly, and you're like, you know what, Dane? I want to start Naz Reid here. Like, do you not think that there would be like a political cost to that?
Of course, no doubt.
But so that's why when I heard you say that, I was like, man, I just feel like you're brushing over that. Like,
of course, there's 100% a political cost there. That's why I ultimately don't think it's going to happen. It would offend Julius Randle. He'd pout. He'd be unhappy. So you kind of have no choice but to start him. Maybe it's more about who finishes these games, but also every series is different. That's where Minnesota has an advantage now. There was too much overlap between Naz Reid and Karl-Anthony Towns. They did too many similar things. Randall is completely different, totally different than those guys. And I think that's where now Chris Finch has the luxury of, okay, I can play one of these guys. I can play totally different combinations of two of these guys, and it changes the whole complexion of the team. So I do think the political aspect of it, it's unrealistic to expect Julius Randle to come off the bench unless somehow he bought in and said, oh, some of the greatest players in NBA history have been six-man Manu Ginobili, Kevin McHale. Oh, I can be one of those guys. But I don't think Julius Randle sees it the same way. I wish he did. I would love to see Randle pulverizing bench units. But you can still accomplish that if you're Chris Finch with your rotations and when you have guys out there on the floor. So, yes, I was wrong to even suggest it.
okay, good. I got my poke in there. But here was my poke, because I thought about that too. But I think ultimately that is what is behind you saying that is I want Naz Reid to play more.
Yes,
like
more.
I think
touches,
that is the
more shots. I love, who doesn't love Naz Reid? I love Naz
for
Reid.
Sure, man. Yeah, get on board. But Naz played 22 minutes a game in the games that Carl played last year. That's not enough. The Wolves didn't have a they need to start Naz Reid problem. They had a Naz Reid needs to play seven more minutes a game problem last year. And I think because you want to talk about political capital earned, like Carl had that here too. And Carl closed just about every single game, save for actually one in that Dallas series in the playoffs when Naz was 7-for-8 from three in that game and they closed with Naz. Naz now can be in a closing lineup. So you can start Randall. And you can get to that at the end with it being Rudy and Naz to close the game. And ultimately, I don't like, we also got to like, remember that Naz got it out of the mud in the league, man. Like he's a guy, undrafted, two-way player, made a mil a year for like 4 years. You know, like he's still building in who he is. I don't get the sense at all that Naz was like, I expect to start now that Karl-Anthony Towns has traded. I think Naz's only internal feeling was like, I get more opportunity here. They can give Naz, and they have given Naz more opportunity in these first three games while starting Julius Randle and frankly benefiting off of what you get from Julius Randle starting the game. So I think we can like put the have Randle come off the bench thing to at least put it on ice for a little bit.
Totally fair. Last season, we saw Towns, Gobert, and Naz Reid play on the floor together. For 26 minutes. They did it for 12 minutes in the playoffs.
Need more.
Are we going to see the three big lineup this season? I want to see it, Dane. I want to see the three big lineup, Dane. Come on.
I've wanted it the whole time. I think, in my opinion, Naz is more of a three than he is a five. And Chris Finch might not agree with that completely, but Naz last season was tasked with guarding on the perimeter a bunch. And he acquitted himself really well of moving his feet. Like, Naz is fast. Also, Naz has lost like 50 pounds since he got to the league. It's crazy. I remember him at first summer league. He told me this last year. He said he was 286 at his first summer league. And when I was talking to him last year about how much he weighed, he said 237.
Wow.
He
was big at LSU. He really was.
It was. I don't awesome think that now. Boy had a good diet at LSU. But it's incredible now. He is a skinny guy. He is not a center body type to me. And he's fast, and he can move his feet on the perimeter. I want Finch to trust it. I want him to give Nas a chance to be a defender. And even it's been bothering me now in the Reed Randall lineups, they go zone every time. And the Lakers picked that apart in the first game. It's like, I don't know. I want there to be a greater trust in what Nas can do defensively. It just seems like we're a little bit tethered to 2-3 years ago when Nas was a bad defender, regardless of a position. I just think I've seen enough from him improving, specifically with like his lateral agility to be able to guard and chase on the perimeter. I get it, given who the eight guys are that are playing, that he needs to be center on this team because they don't have another center in the rotation, and Julius Randle apparently doesn't play any center. But I still think Naz Reid's future is as a combo forward more than it is as a true five.
I want more Naz Reid. I love Naz Reid. He's one of my favorite players. I got Gobert over my shoulder. I need a Naz Reid. I love Naz Reid. Dane, I appreciate you joining my show today. Where can we find your stuff?
Yeah, man. Dane Moore NBA podcast. We're doing shows 4 or 5 times a week. I have on all the beat writers who cover the Wolves, and we're just kind of chopping it up all the time. Follow me on Twitter at Dane Moore NBA and YouTube as well.
Appreciate it, Dane. Have a good day. All right, now it's time for your mailbag questions. Thank you guys for sending everything in that you did this week. We have 3 this week, all emails. If you want to hit me up for next week's episode, send in video notes, audio notes, or emails at kocshow@yahoosports.com. Let's get to it. First question is from Michael. He asked a question related to the conversation we just had with Dane Moore. He says, can you explain to me what it is about Tatum that makes the NBA community love to bash him but put Anthony Edwards on a pedestal? I think the answer is simple, really. Ant is cool. He has an aesthetically pleasing game. He gets the Michael Jordan comps for a reason. He has loud dunks. He's got a huge smile. He's fun. And the Wolves, as a team, aren't hated like Boston is. People just don't like East Coast teams. They don't like Boston, big market, championship city, and all that. And Tatum just doesn't have the personality of Anthony Edwards. He just doesn't have that big smile that Ant has. He doesn't have that laugh. And that's another reason why I think people just put Ant on a pedestal. And with Tatum, it's like, okay, he's a more quote-unquote boring superstar. Should people be doing that? No, of course not, because Jason Tatum is amazing. Jason Tatum, he wins the finals where he's not even scoring well because he's an elite defender, because he's a fantastic passer, because he can rebound. Because if you needed him to, Boston doesn't need it very often. Tatum can play small ball 5 for short spurts if he needs to as well. So Tatum doesn't deserve that hate. He doesn't deserve that criticism. But to me, Michael, just ignore it. It doesn't matter. I know you said in your email you're a hardcore, lifelong Celtics fan. It doesn't matter. Embrace the hate, enjoy it. And now let's move on to a question from Kevin, not me. This is a real life Kevin who said, can this year be the first time we see 2 teams in opposite conferences win 70 games? He says the Celtics look like they could make a run at it, and then OKC looks like a juggernaut in the West. I don't think so. I think 70 is way too high of a bar. Maybe 2 teams winning 65 games is something we could see happen over 67 games. But 70, I think that line is a bit too much for both of those teams, especially for OKC. The West is loaded. There's a lot of great teams. Guys fall in and out of the rotation. They're inevitably going to lose some eventually. 2 teams winning 70, I'd be shocked there. Our final question from Kyle. Kyle asked, he started listening to Father John Misty based on my recommendation and because we have Father John Misty as the lead song of this podcast. And Kyle asked, are there any other artists that you recommend branching out to? Here's some for you. I think The War on Drugs, if you like Father John Misty. Father John Misty is much more lyrical. He tells a story with his songwriting. The War on Drugs, musically, to me, are just like they feel so good. It is such a relaxing sound. The albums, A Deeper Understanding, Lost in the Dream, I would check those out. Mount Joy, I love Mount Joy. They're one of my favorite bands. Much different than Father John Misty. Great live shows. They're a lot of fun. Check them out. All 3 of their albums are great. Maybe not quite Father John Misty like, but they come to mind. I would check out Big Thief. They have a lot of lyrically beautifully songs, musically beautifully as well. Maybe check out the album Dragon New Warm Mountain. I believe you. I know that's a tongue twister, but check that out, them out. And then just tack it on, you know, maybe early St. Vincent before she went more pop. Check out early St. Vincent. You might like her as well. I'd be curious if there's any people listening to this podcast that enjoy Father John Misty who would make recommendations that are like Father John Misty, because I don't think there's many artists that are like him that are coming out with music today. I think Father John Misty is very unique in today's music world. So we'll let Father John Misty play us out to end this today's podcast. I appreciate everybody listening to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Please subscribe if you haven't done that already. Give us a 5-star rating. Thank you to John and Joe and Brett for producing. Really does help out a lot. If you leave us 5 stars, please do that. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Hope you have a good rest of your day. Enjoy the games this week, and we'll be back on Friday again with Tom Havistro. Have a good rest of your week, everybody.